following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening, I'm Megan Turcato. In the news this week, Vancouver celebrates car-free day with pedestrian-friendly street parties, British Columbia continues to have the highest rate of poverty in the country, and an interview with the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, Beverly Jacobs. We'll have all this, plus your weekend weather forecast, coming up in the next hour here on News 101. First up tonight is Carrie Baptist's report on the high rates of poverty in British Columbia.
Today I spoke with Adrienne Montigny, the provincial coordinator of First Call, a local anti-poverty advocacy coalition. Unfortunately, the audio from our discussion was compromised, but I'd like to bring you what I can of our discussion. According to a recent poll conducted by the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition, 79% of British Columbians consider a poverty reduction plan for BC with legislated targets and timelines a priority. BC is one of the few provinces in Canada without a provincial poverty reduction plan, even while having the highest poverty rates in the country. According to Ms. Montigny, the poverty in British Columbia is exacerbated by the housing shortage and the high cost of living. Several policies must be enacted, mainly by the provincial and federal governments, in order to alleviate poverty, including a higher minimum wage, which would be a living wage, universal child care, increased amounts of subsidized housing, and improved mass transit. Ms. Montigny emphasized that many of those who are living in poverty are actually the working poor. They are single and dual-income families, where the parents are working several jobs and still struggling to pay the bills. Also, a living wage is more than just a minimum wage.
Not just a minimum wage, because a minimum wage wouldn't take you out of poverty.
A living wage embodies the concept that people should be able to rise out of poverty through work. In terms of what we can do locally here in Vancouver, Ms. Montigny pointed out that the City of Vancouver owns a lot of land, which it could use, partnering with the province, to build subsidized housing. The local government can also put pressure on the transit authorities to expand service, make transit more affordable, and support unionization drives. Speaking about the economy...
Well, the economy is not some amorphous thing. It's a collection of choices that we make together.
And from this perspective, recession or not, we can choose to shape our economy around our values and principles, and the practices we believe will make our community the healthiest and strongest.
In a recent report, the BC Medical Association has recommended that addiction be recognized as a form of chronic illness. Now we will go to People's First Radio in Nanaimo for their interview with the report's lead author, Dr. Xiaohu Liu.
This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 in Nanaimo.
Welcome back to People First Radio. I'm Kevin. I'm here with Jan. Addiction affects nearly 400,000 people in British Columbia. Those who suffer from this disease are not only the visibly homeless, they come from every socioeconomic, geographic, cultural, and age demographic. And their struggles include not only addiction to illicit drugs, but also the more prevalent addictions to alcohol and gambling. Last week, the British Columbia Medical Association released a policy paper called Stepping Forward, Improving Addiction Care in British Columbia. The lead author of the report and chair of the Medical Association's Council on Health Promotion is psychiatrist Dr. Xiaohu Liu. He's on the line with us today. Welcome to People First Radio, Dr. Liu.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm wondering if we could start out with what was perhaps the most widely reported recommendation from your report, and its first recommendation, in fact, that addiction be formally recognized as a chronic treatable disease under the BC Primary Care Charter and the BC Chronic Disease Management Program. Tell us more about that.
Addiction has always been recognized as a process that causes social harm, dating back to the days of Aristotle and certainly in all ancient cultures. What we have come to understand over the past decade or so is, with the accumulation of research, clinical experience, that addiction is indeed a treatable disease with real biological factors. British Columbian suffers from addictions. Our physicians have been treating patients with addictions ever since it's been a problem. What we want to do at this point is to formally recognize that addiction indeed is a chronic disease. And by doing so, what it helps is to create a more comprehensive treatment plans, flow sheets, and to treat addiction from a more holistic fashion.
It's an interesting, in the Victoria Times columnist just this past week, the chief of police was commenting that, you know, this more serious problem is alcohol-related addiction issues, that people acting out in public, and there's been such a focus on street addiction to hard drugs that the other aspects of addiction seem to have fallen by the wayside. And yet, according to the statistics, a vast number of people in British Columbia are addicted. 1 in 10, that's 400,000 British Columbians, suffer from some form of addiction or dependence, and that's not including tobacco. So this is sort of a timely approach that you're hoping to put into place here.
Yes, and one of the what we see of the homeless population and the criminal elements of addiction is the tip of the iceberg. And it's behind all of that is in the everyday community, where individuals who we work with, our family members with addictions, that make up the bulk of the social and human tragedy that afflicted by addiction.
That's right. There for another statistic here is 1 in 10 patients in Vancouver General Hospital's emergency department was there due to substance abuse problems. Something like 48,000 hospital days in BC were utilized for purposes of substance abuse. And that's including, I don't know, things like 31,000 people with severe gambling problems, high probability of alcohol dependence, 120,000. They're pretty serious statistics.
They're serious statistics. I work at Vancouver General Hospital, and I'm aware of that report, and I would have to say, based on our understanding, that is probably even a low estimate of the problem associated with addictions. And what we generally see in addiction is, in the community, is someone who's intoxicated. But what other things that we don't see are, for example, individuals who are in their 50s become demented because of alcoholism, so require long-term care support. We don't hear about the 19-year-old kid who have an alcohol binge and wind up being an paraplegic for the rest of his life. Those are the challenges that we face each and every day. And so the visible problem associated with alcohol is both devastating in the long term, but the other thing is it really affects the social and economic status of a community.
Dr. Liu, you mentioned the social and human tragedy associated with addiction, untreated addiction, and you also used a phrase, the tip of the iceberg. We've been talking here about the way society views addiction and the notion of, I suppose, people in hardcore street-oriented addictions being just the tip of the iceberg. I'm wondering, how did we get here? What is the tendency within society and within our systems to view addiction as, I imagine, always somebody else's problem and it has nothing to do with us or our family?
Because there's tremendous shame and stigma. And shame and stigma arise from the real fact that there are, up to this point, a lot of people think there are nothing you can do about addiction. Drug addict is seen as somebody who almost a cast off in society. We don't see that, in fact, people do get better. People can make changes. There are medical and social as well as psychological interventions that can help individual recover. When there are the perception that a disease cannot be treated, there's a lot of fear. Most individual will not, and that's a BCMA survey, Canadian Medical Association survey recently showed that most individual would not socialize co-worker with addiction. Most individual would not volunteer to talk about their personal or family addictions because there's tremendous shame. And so how we get here in terms of all the problem and we don't see is this prejudice that we all have that addiction, one can't do anything about it. And it is by breaking those barriers and recognizing that it is a disease, there are meaningful treatment approach that we can take to help these folks. That's when we're going to get somewhere.
This is People First Radio. We're talking with Dr. Xiaohua Liu about the British Columbia Medical Association's recent policy paper on addictions care in the province. Dr. Liu, over 48,000 hospital days in BC in 2004 and 5 were utilized for substance abuse. And according to the documents that we have here that accompanied your paper, those were enough hospital days to fill Kelowna General Hospital every day for a year. Can the government really afford not to formally recognize addiction as a chronic treatable disease?
And I cannot agree with you more, because the statistic on substance abuse costs in Canada, extrapolated, it costs British Columbia in 2002 about $6 billion a year in terms of healthcare costs, law enforcement, insurance problems, lost productivity to BC in 2002. That's probably about $1,500 a year. And if we don't treat that, that cost come out of somewhere else.
What's the response to your paper so far to this endeavor?
When we drafted this paper, we spoke to health authorities throughout British Columbia, including the Vancouver Island health authorities. We have contacted the ministry, and we have overwhelming support for our paper. We are incredibly encouraged that the Vancouver Sun editorial board has given us a full support in Tuesday's paper, I believe. And also, Minister Abbott have come out and say, yes, he agrees that addiction is indeed a chronic treatable disease. And so I think the public is ready to step forward, pardon the pun about our report, and is ready to step forward in to really take this illness and bring it to light.
Is there anything that the average person could do to help endorse this, this proposal? And what could we do?
I think the average person can do a lot. I think by talking about it, by understanding more about it, by keeping an open mind and understand the impacts of addiction, to learn more about the issues. And your previous segment is on voluntarism. There are tremendous amount of opportunity for individual to get to understand what this disease and issues are. I think the public awareness can make substantial impact. Look at cancer. In the 1940s, 1950s, it is a highly stigmatized disease. We would not think of that problem as something that one would discriminate against or have a stigma now. And I think we are ready to move forward. And by recognizing addiction as a treatable illness, we will be actually the first province in Canada to do so. So we are in the cutting edge in the nation.
It is extraordinary to hear you mention that at one time cancer was a disease that was highly stigmatized, and I had forgotten that. I'd heard that, I'd read about that, but it does seem extraordinary that that was the case at one point in time. And, I hear you speaking about British Columbia potentially being the first province in Canada to recognize the chronic and treatable nature of the disease of addiction. And from what I gather from what you've said, there's been a fair amount of positive response, at least in comments. I'm wondering, what will it take for this recognition to impact the BC Primary Care Charter and the BC Chronic Disease Management Program? I'm just wondering if there's a little bit more there that we need to watch for.
Yes, one of the ones the government give us approval for the chronic disease charter, we will strike up committees to develop flowcharts to encourage primary care physicians to approach addictions in a more holistic fashion and in a more standardized fashion. So that's one component. Other element involve greatly expanding current detoxification of residential treatment spaces. We also recommend greater integration and communication between community resources and physicians as a whole. And we also point the light onto BCMA itself by encouraging greater education and training from medical student education all the way to subspecialty recognition of addiction. So it is not just one single recommendation, but to put it in the full spectrum, all the way from research process to frontline education, and also in building greater capacities.
Dr. Liu, we have just about a minute left here in our time. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add to our conversation today.
I think what we need to know is whether or not we accept it as a chronic disease or not. It is a chronic disease. The recognition is what will help make it move forward. Just as hypertension is a chronic disease, addiction is a chronic disease. And we just want to advocate that addiction be treated like any other disease, no more, no less, and give it the funding and the resources that it truly deserves, given the scope and the impact of its problems.
I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate taking the time, and it's a very amazing plot that's afoot coming out of the BC Medical Association. We'd really like to thank you for sharing with us.
And thank you for your interest, and thank you for your listeners' interest.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Shao.
Thanks to Kevin Mimbo and Jan Coleman from People First Radio for that report. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
CITR 101.9 and Discorder Magazine are hosting an epic Canada Day party at the Astoria. Come celebrate 142 years of Confederation featuring Gang Violence, Reflections, MT40, and guest DJs Ian Wyatt and No Gold. Doors are at 10 p.m., show starts at 11. Join us for a night of amazing local sounds at 769 East Hastings, the Astoria, on Wednesday, July 1st.
Come on, pretty baby. Leave tonight for the TD Canada Trust Vancouver International Jazz Festival. From June 26th to July 5th, enjoy free shows from Gastown to Granville Island. This festival has everything, from live jazz to free workshops at the Tom Lee Music Hall. Hundreds of artists will hit the stage, including the King Khan and Barbecue Show, Pink Martini and Orchestra, and Jose Gonzalez. Visit www.coastaljazz.ca to discover all the hidden gems at the TD Canada Trust Vancouver International Jazz Festival.
One night to be confused, one night to speed up truth.
It's a bat. It's a float plane. No, it's the Evaporators.
Soaring in and bringing supplies on June 23rd,
the Evaporators launched their new 7-inch A Wild Pair. Andrew WK joins them at Neptune Records for a live performance from 4 to 6 p.m.
And if that's not enough, head over to the Biltmore at 8 for an encore performance with the Vicious Cycles.
It'll make you want to fly.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Last Sunday was Car Free Day. I went out to speak with people enjoying the public festivals.
Last Sunday, June 14th, was Car Free Day in Vancouver. The city played host to several street festivals on Commercial Drive, Main Street, and in the West End. Our own Megan Turcotta was on the scene at Commercial Drive talking to Craig Ohlenberger about the purpose of Car Free Day.
So a whole bunch of volunteers get together and raise some money and shut down the streets all over the city.
And why do you think it's important to have these Car Free Days?
It's to sort of strengthen the community through interaction and through using, you know, our public space that we've got. I mean, the streets don't just have to be for cars, that is.
Why did you personally want to get involved?
It's a fun group. It's a fun activity. People seem to enjoy it. That's what I like doing in this neighborhood. The Commercial Drive is all about that.
Is there anything particularly you feel like you're accomplishing by having Car Free Day, or is it just...
Well, it's getting people to think of streets as something other than just for cars. It's public space. It's some of the last public space we have, and it's public space we can use for whatever we want.
Megan also spoke with local shark activist Martin Sims.
Basically, what we're trying to do is, it's just me and a friend, we're not part of an organization. We're trying to help save the lives of thousands of sharks that are killed needlessly every hour of every single day. And the big thing that people can do within the Vancouver community is they can basically go into their local Chinese restaurants or Asian restaurants, find out what's on the menu, look at, like, you know, if they have shark fin soup or other shark fin related products on the menu, and then simply give us information.
So yeah. How are the sharks being needlessly killed?
Okay, basically one of the biggest problems is long lining.
Mm-hmm.
In the world of the oceans out there right now, there are on average 192 sharks being killed every single minute, which is obviously adds up to quite a large statistic. That's 11,500 sharks per hour, and over the total course of a year.
And what's long lining? Can you describe that?
Long lining is where basically a shipping trawler trawls a long line. It's kind of self-descriptive, which is between 1,500 and 62 kilometers in length. So pretty much it's indiscriminate fishing. It catches absolutely everything that goes onto the hook. It's baited hook, so every 100 meters there's a hook just dangling with bait on it.
Mm-hmm.
So everything gets caught in it, from albatrosses to leatherback turtles, any type of fish which goes to grab it. It's not just sharks. So really we're talking about sharks here, but we're really talking about the whole industry in itself. If you take away the demand for sharks and shark fin soup, shark fin related products, or shark products in general, such as oils, teeth, stuff like that, then what you're doing is you're taking away the supply for it. Fishermen won't be able to make profit, they won't be able to make money. So we want to start, like, right back at kind of the ground level, the foundation level, and remove that demand.
And so what will you do when you hear about a restaurant that's serving shark fin soup or some related product?
The idea at the moment is we're trying to recruit volunteers, because there's only two of us involved in this. We're not part of an organization, we're not affiliated with anyone, we're just care about this, I guess. What we want to do is we want to send the volunteers round to those restaurants, and we're going to be producing flyers with simple information. So it's kind of a basic approach. We're not going for anything aggressive. We just want to give people information and, in a sense, educate them with facts and information and figures. I think figures always impress people, especially what I was saying earlier about 192 sharks per minute. A lot of people simply don't know that. You know, they're just obviously interested in the profit of their own restaurant or establishment. So we want to, as I said before, go back in, try and educate the people, hopefully get them to take shark fins off the menu so that they won't be serving it to their customers.
Is there a type of fishing alternative that you'd rather see put in practice instead of long lining?
I think you could discuss the concept of sustainable fishing, but right now the biggest problem is that there simply aren't enough sharks left in the ocean to keep this going. You could talk about sustainable fishing, but, well, pretty much since 1980, the shark population has been reduced by 90%, and within some shark groups, there's only 1% of the original statistic. You run out of tape space.
So why are you so passionate about sharks? As you said, you're not part of an organization. What is you and your friends' motivation to save the sharks?
Okay, Julie and I met on the Galapagos Islands. I was working as a volunteer for the Charles Darwin Foundation. Julie was working in a dive shop, and we're very keen scuba divers. And people have this impression of sharks based on, you know, kind of the urban myth, based on movies like Jaws and unfortunate kind of media relations with sharks. That sharks are all dangerous. Sharks are all, you know, scary. They're all like bloodthirsty creatures out there to just gobble up human beings whose legs are dangling in the water. Which, of course, is, like, you know, absolute joke. You know, less than 5 people a year are killed by sharks. Julie and I, when we were on Galapagos Islands, You would swim with sharks, mm-hmm. you would snorkel with sharks, you would scuba dive with sharks. We're talking hammerhead sharks, white-tipped reef sharks, and Galapagos sharks. There's silky sharks, there's basking sharks, and all of these sharks are being targeted within the Galapagos Marine Reserve because of their fins. And the Galapagos Marine Reserve is a marine reserve. Mm-hmm. It's like a precious area, and I can't imagine someone going to Stanley Park with a chainsaw and cutting down trees and getting away with it. But like out there, it actually happens, and we realize that, you know, even just as two people, we can make a big difference.
So if people are hearing this and do want to help you out and get involved as a volunteer, who would they contact?
Well, they can write to us at sharklove@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. That's L-U-V. Sorry, the other one wasn't available. Or they can look into other organizations such as Wild Aid and Sea Shepherd, Greenpeace, who have their own campaigns. Sea Shepherd especially is an organization which Julie and I are, I think we're going to take this concept that we have to Sea Shepherd and mm-hmm. try and get this a little bit bigger. We realize that as two people, we simply can't do that much. And I think that that's one of the problems with people who really want to do volunteering is they just think, I'm just one person, what can I do? But in actual fact, everyone needs to come together and like realize that they're all talking the same language, all the different organizations are, all the different individuals, and if they just like kind of communicated in a better way, then they'll be able to do a lot more as a group.
So lastly, do you think you could describe the outfit that you're wearing right now?
The outfit that I'm wearing is a quick improv outfit based on blue body paint, and a friend of mine managed to steal some blue blinds out of the back of a trash can, and they folded the blinds up, taped them all together, and I've got a fin on my back held together with string, and I'm covered in blue body paint, so I'm pretty much like trying to look like a shark, but I got some goggles as well which keep slipping off. Yeah, it's fun, it's attracting attention, and yeah, I guess we're again getting a little bit more media press for those poor sharks out there.
Megan also spoke to Gord Hill, an anti-Olympics activist, who here is describing his setup at Commercial Drive Car Free Day.
So we have fencing with kind of like mock barbed wire and closed circuit television cameras to replicate the security that the police are going to set up in 2010, just to give people here a visual idea of what the security planning is going to look like. So with the surveillance cameras and the security fencing, where people are going to have special ID to pass in and out of these security zones. So just kind of, you know, just trying to raise people's awareness about the real impact of 2010 when they actually set up here for the Olympics.
And can you describe a little bit about the security zones and what those are going to be during the Olympics, or what they're designed to, I guess, control?
Well, the security zones are going to be set up around all the Olympic venues, the Athletes Village, and some of the live sites that they're going to have. And they're basically to control the movement of people in and out of these areas and protesters as well. So it's going to be designed to stop any kind of disruption of the Olympic events.
So what do you hope people get out of your mock, I guess, security zone today? What do you want people to learn?
Just an appreciation of the, you know, the kind of security setup that they're going to have, the kind of restrictions on civil liberties that they're going to have, because we've been having workshops on legal rights as well as medical training. Just so raising awareness for people so they'll have a better understanding of the impact of 2010 and why we're resisting the Olympics.
So if people were interested in getting more information about resisting or about your media clinics or anything else, who could they contact?
Well, they can check out our website, which is www.no2010.com. And from there, they can access the Olympic Resistance Network, which is the main organizing group for anti-Olympic resistance here. And their email address is olympicresistance@riseup.net.
And do you feel comfortable giving me your name?
My name is Gord Hill. I'm from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation and one of the indigenous organizers for the anti-Olympics campaign.
This is kind of another question, but do you have specific concerns about... there's been a lot of talk about no Olympics on stolen native land. Do you want to elaborate on that? Or I don't know if a lot of people understand that slogan, if you feel comfortable.
Well, no Olympics on stolen native land is because we're organizing on an anti-capitalist and anti-colonial basis. So saying no Olympics on stolen native land is a way of raising people's consciousness about the history of colonization here in the province, and to to remind people that this is stolen land. Indigenous peoples have, you know, have been dispossessed of their lands and their territories, and that's why they're the most impoverished and oppressed population here. So we want people to be aware of that, and you know, just to raise that awareness among people.
Is there any other thoughts about, I guess, that you'd like to leave the audience with today?
Well, continuing on with that, no Olympics on stolen native land. Like, one of the things about BC that people, we want people to understand, is that almost all the province is unceded, unsurrendered Indigenous territory, which is a violation of the Canadian and international law. Under the 1763 Royal Proclamation, the British and later Canada were supposed to acquire treaties before any trade or settlement or business could occur. And that's why we say this is stolen land here in BC, because they didn't make any treaties.
Thanks for talking to me.
Now we'll go to an interview with the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, Beverly Jacobs.
International, Aboriginal women are 5 times more likely to die violently than other Canadian women. In your opinion, why is this the case?
There's a lot of reasons why. We're dealing with the impacts of colonization since colonization, where Aboriginal women have taken the brunt of the cycle of violence, residential school system, the Indian Act system that's based on patriarchy and Victorian rules of how women are treated. And so, you know, as a result of that, which is totally different than the way that our traditions and our culture has been made up of respect and honor to women. As a result, that's what we're, you know, having to deal with today. I guess I can give you an example of how, you know, we're dealing with the impacts of colonization when it comes specifically to the Indian Act system.
Okay.
So, for example, a woman under the Indian Act system, if she marries a man other than a native status man, because under the Indian Act, based on patriarchy, the only way to be a registered Indian is if you're married to that man or a child of that man. And so, as a result, it caused total sexual discrimination. So if a woman married a man who was not status, she was forcefully displaced from her community, from her territory, and so she was no longer considered an Indian. So she would have had to leave her community, her home. Her children would not have been raised with the family, and also because we also raised our families with extended families and connections to the land and territories, as a result, there was a total disconnection as a result of that. So right from the get-go, there were women who were forced to leave their communities. So right there is sort of the beginning of how women disappeared, mm-hmm. Not knowing where she might have gone to, unless she was able to maintain her culture and her where she came from and their strength. She would have been able to maintain that connection no matter what. Also under the Indian Act system was the creation of the residential schools. And the residential school system, again, was a process of genocide, a process of assimilation policies from the Canadian government itself, and contracting with churches to Christianize and make Aboriginal people and turn them into white people. And so as a result, the impacts to women specifically, you know, according to our traditions and our culture, there was always honor towards women as being the life givers, the ones who carry children, who bring that spirit from the Creator. And there's teachings, you know, from our elders and from our traditions, right from the time that we're born, about our responsibilities. And so we're talking about generations and generations of those teachings that were totally cut off. And so it created a whole process of that lack of understanding. Also in residential schools was the violence and the abuses, every kind of abuse you can think of, whether it was physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse. All of those things occurred in residential schools. And so when you have a whole systemic process to abuse children, of course, it's an oppressive process. And we're in the midst of that today. And a lot of those women who, those generations of women who went through that system and trying to raise their families had difficulties in not knowing what it was like to raise children. So there's the whole cycle of abuse, the whole disrespect to each other as people, as men and women, and so now we're dealing with this whole cycle of violence as a result today.
And are there other stemming from that maybe, or in addition, socioeconomic or cultural problems today that are causing the violence we're seeing?
Well, the whole cycle of violence itself is about abuse of power, right? That's what abuse is. And I believe today that the government itself is still an abuser. So they're controlling the dollar, and it's about a control. So the issues of poverty and the issues that we're having to deal with today are still the impacts of colonization.
You hear a lot of stories about law enforcement not responding adequately to reports of missing Aboriginal women or violence against Aboriginal women. Can you maybe describe some of the challenges that the Aboriginal community often faces when reporting these cases?
There has been a difficulty in trusting police because of there's a systemic problem with respect to policing and Aboriginal peoples. And so, and this has all been documented. This is all, you know, in inquiries in the Manitoba Justice Inquiry, in the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in Canada. You know, these are all researched and documented of the relationship and the distrust of policing with Aboriginal people. And so that affects Aboriginal families themselves who may be discriminated against or not listened to or not understood. And so it causes even further difficulties for families who are grieving if someone's missing or if they've been found murdered.
So the UN review of Canada's human rights policy was critical of Canada's record on protecting the human rights of Aboriginal women. The UN report made numerous recommendations, many of which the Canadian government rejected, including a recommendation that Canada should collect statistics on the scale of the problem and institute a national strategy to combat it.
Mm-hmm.
What is your reaction to the federal government's response to this UN report?
I think they're totally wrong. And families all along have been asking for answers. It's about justice for those women who are either missing or found murdered. When we look collectively at the numbers and the systemic problems, I really believe that they need to look at why this is happening, why society isn't aware, why, you know, it's not considered a crime where Aboriginal women are targets of violence.
So you were mentioning this before, that there's been a lot of other commissions, the Manitoba Justice Commission, the Royal Commission on Aboriginals. How hopeful are you that should an inquiry into the large number of missing and murdered Aboriginal women in BC go ahead, that the recommendations mm-hmm. would actually be taken seriously?
Yeah, but I think that's what the question is. The question is what an inquiry or an investigation into the situation would be. I think that's what needs to be looked at, because we do have all of these other inquiries and knowing about the processes for inquiries, because we're dealing with the spirits of these women and the spiritual aspect and emotional and traumatizing aspect of the lives of and families of the women who are still here, and that it really needs to be really investigated into what that whole process would look like. So if it's going to follow the other types of inquiries that have been out there, where a lot of times they're shelved and the recommendations are shelved and gathering dust, I think that's that has to end. And so we have to figure out a process where some very concrete actions occur as a result of an investigation.
So what actions do you think need to be taken by the government or society more generally to make Canada a safe place for Aboriginal women?
Well, I think there's a bigger, broader issue of education, of educating people, of educating all people, all society, about, you know, the basics of history of our people, of nationhood, of our connections to our lands and territories, and the relationship that we have spiritually, and why we continue to fight for our rights, our inherent rights to who we are as a people and where we come from, and reclaiming who we are as a people and revitalizing our traditions and our culture and those principles of our traditional laws.
So is there anything else just more generally that you'd like people to know about, I guess, the challenges facing Aboriginal women in Canada? Or
well, I think everybody knows what the challenges are. I really want to, you know, continue and maybe even changing the focus into the successes of Aboriginal women, the successes of Aboriginal people, and the resilience of who we are as a people, and to start celebrating that, because despite all of, you know, what we've had to go through as a people, we're still here, and we're still, you know, connected to our ceremonies. We're still connected to the land, and we're still protecting our lands and territories. And I think it's important that that people understand that as a success, rather than looking at it negatively.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Bye. A lot.
That was an interview with the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, Beverly Jacobs. We're going to take another break now, but stay tuned for more national news and your weather forecast coming up next on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys, girls, and everything in between, step right up as the Youth Co-Aid Society proudly presents Acquired Taste, a carnival of sensations.
On July 9th at 7 p.m., the Big Top hits Canvas Lounge at 99 Powell Street with a feast of all things circus, featuring burlesque and belly dancers, drag performers, aerialists, fire spinners, and jugglers. All proceeds from the premier silent auction go to support prevention education in youth impacted by HIV/AIDS.
Auction donations and ticket purchases can be handled at www.youthco.org or the Youth Co office downtown. Sponsor a ticket for someone else in true circus style, one night only, July 9th.
CSAFA is pleased to announce the 7th annual Sewan Mela and Bollywood Under the Stars event. The event takes place on the 13th and the 14th of June 2009 at the Lumberman's Arch in Stanley Park. The cross-culture celebration is going to be a crowd pleaser, various world music, multicultural dances, and Bollywood Indian films. For more information, please visit the website www.safa.ca. The SAFA invites you all to be part of this amazing weekend for cultural harmony.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101. It's 5:50. Here's an interview from CHUO in Ottawa with Peter Dinsdale, Executive Director of the National Association of Friendship Centres, talking about urban First Nations issues.
Peter Dinsdale, Executive Director of the National Association of Friendship Centers. Thank you for taking the time out of your extremely busy schedule to come onto the program today, Peter.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
Great. So can you tell our listeners quickly about the National Association of Friendship Centers, who it represents?
Sure. We're a national Aboriginal organization, and we provide supports for local friendship centers across the country. There's 120 of them, and we have seven regional bodies. And nationally, we provide some programs. Mostly, we do policy support and advocacy on some of the issues in town here.
Mm-hmm. The association is hosting an all-candidates forum on urban First Nations issues.
That's right.
So already this week, the Assembly of First Nations announced the candidates for National Chief. We have Sean Atleo, Perry Bellegarde, John Bocage, Terrence Nelson, and Bill Wilson, as of this week, have announced their candidacy. In your opinion, what do you think are the most, you know, important things that need to be addressed during this this run for the candidacy for the chief?
Well, I think one of the important issues will need to be urban issues. Increasingly, the demographics are showing, which is kind of a dry thing to talk about, but half of all First Nations people live in cities, and we aren't always seeing half of the policy issues or half of the advocacy taking place addressing those issues. And rightly so, there's a lot of challenges on First Nations, unresolved land claims, the, of course, residential school issues and the follow-up, clean water, living conditions, general poverty. There's no shortage of issues for them to deal with. But I think one of the issues they need to start to turn their attention to is, how do they handle this issue of their people living in cities? How do they represent them? What are some of the mechanisms that might need to be in place in order to properly advocate for them, provide services? How are they taking care of their citizens? And we are real honored that they're coming, and three of the candidates are coming to speak to that issue, and we hope to get a sense from them what their plans are during the next term.
Mm-hmm. So have you noticed anything in the platforms of any of these candidates right now that are going to address urban Aboriginal issues?
There's been a couple specifically. I think Sean Atleo and John Bocage have as a part of their kind of main campaign streams, and I have heard Perry Bellegarde talk about it. One of Sean Atleo's kind of favorite campaign lines is, we didn't create these divisions, and as nations, we shouldn't abide by them. So he's speaking that kind of language of recognizing that there's artificial divisions, that we've allowed ourselves to fall into those divides, and we need to find ways of working together to overcome them. I think John's talked similar language. John Bocage has talked around issues of representing their citizens no matter where they choose to live. And as we all know, I think it's easy to say you're going to represent those citizens. It's harder to do it, so it's a great opportunity to hear from them how they think they can.
Mm-hmm. But generally, the Assembly of First Nations, a lot of the people they're working for, they're representing, are living on reserve. Mm-hmm. So how can the Assembly of First Nations be working to advocate more or ensure that people living off reserve are being served?
I think it's a tough question. I'm glad I'm not in their moccasins on this one in general, because I think they're in a no-win situation. They focus too much on it. I think the chiefs rightly will say you need to represent and address the concerns that we're raising. In the Assembly of First Nations Charter, the kind of governance documents, they say the national chief gets their authority from the chiefs in assembly. They don't have authority outside of that. So if you're representing the chiefs in assembly, you have to represent their priorities. And you have that along with the challenge of a lot of their people not living in those communities or voting in those elections. So how do you cut through some of that? I think there's some opportunities. You know, in 2005, the Assembly of First Nations had a renewal commission where they examined how they could renew their strength. And they had many recommendations. One of them that caused a lot of buzz was this notion of universal vote. One status Indian, one vote for national chief. And we haven't seen as much movement on that potentially as maybe we could have. So I think these candidates have an opportunity to talk about their support for universal vote and what that might look like. I think you need to balance the concerns of the local First Nations governance, their leaders, with this kind of notion. But I think we should strive towards that balance. I think the Assembly of First Nations could have an urban caucus of the group work that they do. They could have their secretariat look at some of those issues. You know, we're a collection of service providers as friendship centers. I think there's other issues, other women's shelters. There could be urban reserves. There could be economic development in urban areas. There's a bunch of issues that are urban related that just aren't ours. I think it's a great opportunity to start to engage in that dialogue.
Mm-hmm. So not only building this there is a relationship being built between the National Association of Friendship Centers mm-hmm. and the Assembly of First Nations, but you're saying also we need to also include all the other organizations out there.
You know, we did sign a memorandum of understanding in 2006 about how we would cooperate on some policy areas. I think we would, you know, our instinct is we would like to see that strengthened and built upon. I think it was a great first step, and we were breaking down some barriers, and I think, you know, if I'm honest, I think we have ways to go still. So, but it's not just about us. I think, you know, because of this unique relationship we have, we can do these other work to help facilitate maybe dialogues. And how do we broaden that circle? And how do we really take a comprehensive approach in looking at where our citizens live? Because campaign rhetoric aside, we really are, if we want to behave as nations, we can't abide by other people's definitions of our communities and where they reside.
Mm-hmm. So what is there anything in particular you're hoping to hear at the debate tomorrow?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues that are kind of related to these we haven't really spoke to yet. One is there's a recent BC Court of Appeals decision called Sharon McIver, and that decision is around the Indian Act and areas of the Indian Act, how Indians become registered. There was some changes made in 1985 called Bill C-31, which allowed Aboriginal women who married non-Aboriginal men, they lost their status. It was about giving them and their children their status back. And when they made the legislative changes, it kind of prevented a whole bunch of people from passing on their Indian status to their children, and primarily it's women that aren't able to pass on as long as men were, if you trace your lineage. Sharon McIver decision is making the federal government change that portion of the Indian Act. So what it's going to do for us is there'll be more status Indians who do not live on reserve. Mm-hmm. They require services in cities. They require different kind of relationships with their First Nation. I'd like to hear what their plans are on that. It's a lot like when Bill C-31 first came in place. There's a whole bunch more status Indians. I had tremendous pressures on the First Nations and in urban service providers. What kind of relationships should we have in place to address some of that? So I think that's one of the real big issues we would like to hear addressed. I'd like to hear some of their specific plans around universal vote. How do they think that, what that looks like, and how are they going to work on those challenges, and also hear them acknowledge the demographic challenge which exists, and what kind of partnerships do they see themselves engaging in.
Mm-hmm. And I've been reading in the media then with the McIver decision that there's kind of a pretty quick timetable mm-hmm. where the government is supposed to respond to that. Mm-hmm. So
they have a year. They have till April 2010. The thing where everyone's not sure about is Sharon McIver herself appealed the decision. While she won her case, it was a narrow interpretation of a bunch of other areas the court could have ruled on, including broader discrimination provisions of the Indian Act. So while she had won, it was a limited win, so she herself is applying for leave to the Supreme Court. So if she's successful in that application, it will take a while before it gets resolved. If she's not successful in the application, it'll have to be done by April 2010.
So that's interesting. Another thing I wanted to ask you, mm-hmm. some of the candidates have said that they want the government to reopen the Kelowna Accord mm-hmm. and start implementing that. Do you have any, what's your take on that?
Well, the Kelowna Accord was certainly a momentous achievement. If for the first time it brought 13 different jurisdictions, 14 if you include the federal government, you know, 10 provinces, 3 territories and the feds, and then First Nations organizations, Métis and Inuit, together to come to rather specific outcomes in terms of health, education, economic development, accountability, and housing. It was an incredible achievement. For us, we don't believe it really dealt with urban the way it should have. Urban was always thought as being a lens that was supposed to go across all of those areas. We really didn't see its impact long-term and how it will be helpful. So we're very supportive of Kelowna to addressing those other issues because there's tremendous issues in all those communities. We don't want to minimize that. For us, we'd like to see Kelowna broaden and some of the thinking raised. The litmus test for us always is something like, how is it going to help a single Aboriginal woman and her child in downtown Ottawa? If the education provisions in Kelowna aren't going to do that, if it's not going to result in more housing, if it's not going to result in economic development or better health, for us, it's not successful. And we can't really get behind something that's going to leave that person out. So while we think Kelowna is a beginning, we always say we want Kelowna Plus. We need the Kelowna investments on reserves in Métis communities for Inuit hamlets and their peoples. But I think we also need to think about where the majority of Aboriginal people live and what are the kind of policy prescriptions we're going to have in place. And regrettably, Kelowna didn't do that.
Mm-hmm. So just to wrap up then what do you think are the most important issues for the National Friendship Center movement right now?
Well, it's a growing population. We need better supports, increased supports. You know, the federal government often hides behind this notion of jurisdiction, whether the province has jurisdiction for people in urban areas or the federal government does. As a result, no one shows leadership and very little gets done. I think we need greater and more robust federal investments and understanding, not from a rights base, but from a needs base. Too many of our people live in poverty. Half of all Canada's Aboriginal people live in cities, half are under the age of 25, and half don't graduate from high school. There's no shortage of challenges. We just need resolve to work together.
Mm-hmm. Wow, lots of challenges, lots of work to do, but it looks like the National Association of Friendship Centers is right on the ground and getting things done.
Thanks very much.
Okay, Peter Dinsdale, Executive Director of the National Association of Friendship Centers, thank you very much for being on the program with us today.
Wonderful, anytime.
Okay.
Thanks to Lisa Abel of CHUO in Ottawa for that report. Now with your weather forecast, here's Alice Wong.
Thanks, Megan. Here's your weekend forecast for June 19th to June 22nd. Well, a change is going to come in the weather, although it won't last very long. An incoming cold front is causing the overcast conditions right now and creating an unstable air mass. Expect to see a few showers during Friday evening to the overnight. The nighttime low is 11 degrees. Behind the cold front is an upper-level trough of low pressure that will continue to create unstable conditions and lingering scattered showers. Saturday, it will be a mix of sun and cloud with a 20% chance of showers, daytime high of 19. Sunday, partly sunny with a 40% chance of showers, high of 18. Monday, a ridge of high pressure builds offshore, which will bring mostly sunny conditions and warm the temperature up to a daytime high of 21. Currently, it's 19 degrees and cloudy at YVR. That's your weather this weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Alice Wong.
That's our program. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Carrie Baptist produced this radio program. Join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Megan Tercato. Thanks for listening. Coming up next is Hot Mess. This is CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver.